Welcome once again to the hour of the time, the only hour that ever was, ever will be, or that is. This is the hour that you will decide your future and thus our collective futures. Last night's broadcast was incredible. And because we just barely touched the tip of the iceberg, Vladimir Terzisky has consented to come back tonight and maybe for one more broadcast. We'll see how it goes tonight. And talk about these incredible flying machines that was developed many, many, many years ago that people now call flying saucers or UFOs. And we left off with the development of several models of flying saucer type craft by the Germans during World War II and before World War II. And I believe we were talking about the development of the first jet aircraft when we had to sign off in our last episode of the Hour of the Time. So once again, I'd like to welcome you, Vladimir, to the broadcast. And I'll tell you once again what a pleasure it is to have you with us and to be able to bring some of this hidden technology out into the open so that the common man, people just like you and I sitting in that living room who haven't had this can finally, for once in their life, begin to see the light at the end of the tunnel, get some answers into their life for some of these questions that that people can't get answers to. Why is this technology, why is this hidden? Why are you going to find out these things and you go to research it like you and I have both found out? There are so many blocks put in our way. We find that books have been classified and taken out of libraries, and we find that librarians raise their eyebrows and go off and make a phone call and things.
We find that Orwell is an understatement in many cases.
You're talking about George Orwell.
George Orwell and his 1984 scenario is an understatement in many cases.
Correct.
The way such sensitive information is treated. Before that, though, I would like to thank you for inviting me again to this show and to share a little thought that just came across my mind. You know, I came to this country as a political dissident, as a political refugee and a dissident from Eastern Europe. In Japan, instead of studying physics, I was digging into Russian dissident literature, into basically dissident literature about world communist affairs, about Eastern Europe, about socialism in general, Russia in particular. Back in my country, I still had a secret dream as a physicist to make my little discovery. And that dream was to discover how anti-gravity works. Funnily enough, I was able to answer my dream, to find the answer to that dream, through my dissident diggings into alternative scientific, quasi-scientific, or non-scientific, let's call it anthropological literature.
Sure.
And I'm extremely happy to be on your show here because in your face I see someone who is worthy to be called the American Sakharov. Let's make some parallels between the two evil empires. I think it's high time to make an analogy between the two evil empires. When the Dzerzhinsky statue was toppling on that famous Roman Lublyanka Square, I had another vision in my mind that maybe a similar statue would someday be toppling somewhere in Langley, Virginia, on another famous square.
I think that just possibly might happen if enough Americans wake up.
It is all in our hands. With the collapse of the Russian bear, now the Russian bear is a paper bear, it's not a real bear anymore. This country, the ruling elite of this country, is desperately in need of a new external enemy, and preferably a long-term one. Saddam Hussein footed the bill for a short time. It was a short-term enemy. If there is an invasion in Cuba or possibly Yugoslavia to stop the unrest there, he still was the Panama invasion. He was just short-term enemy. We are desperately in need of a long-term enemy. And some of the stories, some of the scenarios that I've been hearing on the speaker circuit of American ufology, that possibly some alien race may come and invade us in the near future. These could be
other species from some other planet.
Yeah, but this is a story of another future program, possibly. I'm extremely happy to be on your show, and what you are doing here is unfortunately too few Americans are doing. I think that it's high time for America to look back at other Russia and to see how Russian dissidents were fighting with their evil empire for more than half a century. Many of them died, thousands, millions of them died in the concentration camps. 60 million people went through the camps.
Yes, so at least 60 million people that can be accounted.
20 did not return, maybe more than that.
Sure.
But this is the Russian end of the population equation. This is how the Russian secret elite, in collusion with the secret elite of the other country, were trying to solve the population equation. Anyway, back to the secret technologies and to the German anti-gravity research and development. My feeling is that in this particular country, the secret services, the CIA, the NSA in particular, would be tremendous. They snoop not only on terrestrial but also on extraterrestrial communication. Their biggest problem is to find immediately if somewhere, somehow, an inventor appears with a strange invention. Many of the inventions happen by people that have no formal education, are not in the databases, and suddenly one day they come with an incredible conception that works on top of that. Once such a person is discovered, she will be either bought off or silenced, or his whole lab, drawings, books, and sometimes even he himself would disappear. This is how the secret societies have been safely locking into their safes any new technology that is more than 15 years ahead of its time.
Especially technology which threatens one of the core methods of controlling populations, such as energy, food, money, and fear.
Absolutely.
And the main one that is in the hands of the average man to develop, if he has any brains at all, it has to do with energy.
Exactly.
T. Townsend Brown. I'm sure in your research you run across the name Thomas Townsend Brown. The same thing happened with him. He developed a saucer shape or disc shaped craft that he actually flew, demonstrated. But it was a different type of technology that that we discussed in the last program. His craft was basically a capacitor.
Yeah, and flying capacitor.
Right, and by
no moving parts. Any third world nation can make a capacitor.
Absolutely, and he was able to charge this with enough electricity to where the craft. Now I don't really understand how it happened, but I know that it flew. Immediately, he was approached by the Office of Naval Intelligence. His entire lab was packed up. His technology disappeared, all of his notes and books and drawings. And the next thing you know, he's a naval officer attached to the Office of Naval Research and never talked about his invention again.
Exactly.
I don't know what they did, of course.
He was smart enough to sell himself.
basically...
Well, he stayed alive. He said, well, you know, I'm going to take all of my technology with you. If I keep my mouth shut, will you let me go and work on it? That's probably what he said.
Yeah, exactly.
And he derived no benefit from any of it for the rest of his life, and certainly it was not used in the war or anything to protect his country. So the excuse of national defense didn't even...
At the time of a phony Cold War, of a Mickey Mouse Cold War, that we know that behind the back of this Cold War, raging Cold War, quote, quote, they had tacit, quiet cooperation in the exploration of the moon, Mars, with the creation of the survival and evacuation colonies there, and way beyond the solar system with rapidly produced incredible flying saucers, basically along the suspect scenario.
NASA has actually functioned as the Roman circus in this passion play.
Absolutely, and we'll come to that. I think another interesting program that we can do together will be on free energy. This is a topic that I would love to talk, and we can talk as long as we talk about. We've been talking about German UFOs. So back to the UFOs and back to where we were last night. We ended with the first operational fighter saucer, turbojet fighter saucer, developed as a joint project, mega project, by D'Alonso, Mitte, and Schriever, the three luminaries of the German anti-gravity R&D. On its first flight, it reached an altitude of 20 kilometers, which is 6,000 feet. No plane at the time could reach this altitude. At its second flight, it reached 24.
You said 60,000
feet. Okay. On its second attempt, it reached 76,000 feet. And the rumors are that it could make as much as 4,000 kilometers an hour in the subsequent models. From the initial 8 turbojets inside the craft that was spinning the whole airframe, including the fuel tank, but keeping the cabin stationary in the middle, stabilized as usual. The Germans later developed a lot more advanced version that had a single custom-made donut-shaped turbojet engine. If you do a topological transformation in 3D space of a standard salami shaped turbojet engine, if you flatten it, shorten it, and flatten it to the shape of a pancake, and then open a hole in the middle, you don't need the middle anyway, then you can drop the cabin in that hole, gyroscopically stabilize it. It would not spin. Everything else around that cabin would be spinning. The whole hull of the ship would be spinning one way. The insides of the ship, in this case, the air compressor that is coupled to the gas turbine would be spinning the other way. Incredibly simple. This was kerosene burning, air breathing turbojet saucer made of the alloys that they were using for their airplanes. The navigation equipment was the same. Everything was the same. They were just utilizing a different physical principle that is so simple and childish. I've been observing publications, even in Scientific American, which is basically a secondary school level physics publication, judging from European school standards. Even in that magazine...
I'm glad you say that, because judging from the standards here in this country, it's nowhere near a secondary school publication. Our secondary schools have sunk to the level of... I'll tell you the truth. People used to come out of the 8th grade in the 1800s know more about reading and writing and arithmetic than people who come out of our secondary schools in this country today. But that's another subject. But,
I wouldn't... Well, unfortunately, I've been discovering that our education system in an Eastern European country that fights with Romania for the place before the last European country, Albania, has a, fortunately enough, we got our education system from Germany. We just copied everything from there. Compared to our education system, the American public school education system looks like a third world backward country education system, which is no coincidence at all. No. On the contrary, it's designed.
Absolutely.
It's designed to lower the standards of this country, to make it equal to the standards of lesser developed countries so that the one world government can take place.
That's correct.
Back to the German craft. So the Belong to Me distributor disc eventually was developed, they utilized this donut-shaped custom-made turbojet engine. The interesting thing about this saucer is that it probably was able to go into suborbital flights and even into orbital flights. This is a funny story that I've read in a contactee book published by Wendell Stevens, probably one of the best publishers of UFO contactee literature in the country. But in one of the accounts of such a contact with an extraterrestrial race, they mention that they have flying saucers on their planet, several types, but one of the types can fly only inside the atmosphere. And if the pilot gets careless and takes the craft outside and away from the atmosphere, then another craft of an interplanetary capability has to go and fetch the wayward ship and bring it back. And a turbojet engine is a very good candidate for an engine that can work only inside the atmosphere.
Sure.
But having a tremendous velocity, it could easily propel the craft into a suborbital and even an orbital flight. There are two interesting things of anti-gravity physics that I would like to discuss here. Namely, and these are the two magical keys to the saucer kingdom. Number one, when anti-gravity starts working, it negates the mass of the object. Because the Germans were spinning the fuel tanks with a whole hull, the only thing that wasn't spinning in the craft was the cabin in the center.
Mm-hmm.
The fuel was losing its weight too. So basically, it would be very easy, very fuel-wise, it would be very economical to keep that craft in flight. Despite the fact that these crafts were gas guzzlers, there was absolutely no way to attain the altitudes and the speeds with a conventional non-anti-gravity technology. So the first magical key to the saucer kingdom, to the energy efficiency of the saucer kingdom, is the negation of the gravitational mass. The second magical key is the negation of the inertial mass. What it means is that it's like the car that you drive would still have the same engine of 100 horsepower, but suddenly it would weigh as much as if made of styrofoam. And it would be as easily acceleratable as if made of styrofoam. With such a car, you can beat any Formula One car without a problem, because the power to mass ratio would be almost infinite. So the disappearance of the inertial mass is the second and most important and very carefully covered up magical key to the saucer kingdom.
But it's not covered up very well, because we know the space capsules that we've shot into space that have come back to Earth have lost weight. We know this. NASA has released those figures. They haven't explained it, but they have released those figures. And we know that this craft, while it's orbiting the Earth, is spinning all the time.
Well, this is a very interesting phenomenon that I've heard several times mentioned before, but I kind of excluded from my worldwide anti-gravity picture. But it's a little bit different phenomenon. It proves that gravity is a relative thing, and the force of gravity is a relative thing, and it depends not only on the mass and the difference between two attracting bodies, but on other phenomena that happen, which we can talk later. But which helps us understand how certain physical experiments or metaphysical yogi techniques can both decrease or increase the weight of an object. Gravity is, as a variable, depends on other physical variables, not only on mass and distance, as our university physics teaches us. Anyway, because of these two magical keys, the negation of both the gravitational and the inertial mass, even a turbojet saucer can fly into suborbital and even an orbital flight. Not only that, but I've heard rumors that even a ramjet supersonic plane can go into an orbital flight. Actually, the story is about the American SR-71 that was on a reconnaissance flight over Russia way after Gary Powers was shot with his U-2 and spoiled the Russian-American relations for a long time.
I think that was intentional.
Of course. Oh, I mean,
I think that's what Lee Harvey Oswald was doing in the Soviet Union, was giving them the information that they needed to be able to shoot down a U-2, and I think he was sent there by naval intelligence to do that, because there was a lull in the Cold War. Khrushchev was actually getting friendly with the United States, and it wasn't
hard.
his name wasn't Gorbachev.
So, the story is that one bright sunny day at 33,000 meters, which is close to 100,000 feet up there above Mother Russia, the pilot of the SR-71 got a radar lock on by an approaching Russian anti-aircraft rocket.
Mm-hmm.
He got scared. He floored the thing to the metal, and next thing he knew, he was in Earth's orbit. This is a rumor. But I've talked to people at Lockheed, and they verified that pilots were dead scared to press the accelerator of that thing because it would go into suborbital flight until the engines flame out, and then he had to read his paper up there and wait for the thing to re-enter the atmosphere.
Go ahead.
So it is actually quite easy to go into an Earth orbit with technologies that are different and much easier from the rocket technology NASA and the Russians have been using. And this is all very carefully staged and orchestrated smoke that we will talk, for the purposes of that, we will talk later.
Sure.
After the Dolon-Tsumi-Peshchieva turbojet disk, the natural evolution of the genealogy of German anti-gravity research and development takes us inevitably to the rocket engines. At the end of the war, the Germans had about 150 different models of all classes of rockets, from small shoulder launch Stinger type anti-aircraft rockets to giant two-stage ICBMs. Four of these were fired in the United States.
Did any of them reach the United States?
Well, it's an interesting story. I think the first space flights with rockets on this planet happened in the late 30s and early 40s when the Germans started firing their winged manned version of the V-2 rocket, which, according to an article by General Walter Dornberger, who was the in charge of Feminine, and this is a story from
Peter Moonbeam, was for the rocket research.
Yeah, the rocket research. I mean, the German Kate Kennedy.
Yeah.
On the Baltic coast, almost up north from Warsaw, quite to the east from Germany, away from England and the Allies. So the V-2 would reach an altitude of 120 kilometers, which is about 20 kilometers above the usual heights of the orbits of the Voskhod, the Gemini, and the Mercury capsule. So the first suborbital flights were not by Walter Schirra in the late 50s, but by Germans in the early 40s, 15 years earlier. The Germans developed a two-stage giant ICBM called the America Rocket, the America Rocket. The second stage was a standard V-2, but the first stage was, I mean, a V-2 is about three stories tall. The first stage was about six stories tall, so the total rocket was about 10 stories tall. We're talking about 10 by 3, we're talking about 30 meters, about 100 feet tall rocket. It's a monster's rocket, and the size, the height of the assembly hall of the Peenemünde collection facility clearly proves that this is not a three-story tall facility. It is a 10-story tall facility. It simply dwarfs the human beings and the railroad cars. Four of these rockets were fired at the United States, and the rumor is that the second stage was a winged man version on some of these or all of them. These rockets would reach apogee of 350 kilometers. This is the maximum height up from the Earth's surface.
You're talking about intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Absolutely. And this is a height that's about three times as high as the usual space flights.
Mm-hmm.
They developed spacesuits, and I just discovered about 3 days ago a photograph of the first German spacesuit, which looks even more sophisticated than the Gemini. The Mercury spacesuit. The Mercury spacesuit basically is a modified high-altitude airplane.
Sure,
sure. Anyway, so I think these were the first space flights with rocketry on this planet. Back to the rocket-powered flying saucers. At the end of the war, they only had about 150 models of rockets and probably more than 100 models of rocket engines running on different kinds of fuel. Walter Werner von Braun was not the only genius of German rocket building. There were many other names that we never heard anything about.
Sure.
Eugen Zenger was another genius of German aviation. He was 29 when he proposed a suborbital space bomber capable of flying halfway around the globe that will be shot in space with a giant first-stage rocket bigger than the America rocket. And initial construction was begun, but they were never able to complete the project. And many other luminaries that, they're being kept completely under wraps. I wouldn't be amazed that if I discovered that they were quietly moved with the change in identities in the United States or other of the superpowers to continue working for the supergovernment. But the first models of the rocket-powered saucers had, according to many articles that were found in German magazines, and I repeat, these articles are extremely difficult to find. They are not in American libraries. Anyone who is interested in obtaining information can write us. My phone number in Los Angeles is 310-473-9717, and I can send a substantial... I have a huge package of visual information. But the rocket-powered craft had, at the beginning, outboard rocket engines. Later on, they hit the engines inside the spinning disk. These craft were capable of exo-atmospheric flight because they carried the oxidizer on board, so they didn't have to wait for a careless pilot to take them in outer space. All they had to do is press the pedal to the metal.
Mm-hmm.
Carrying the oxidizer on board would take them into Earth's orbit, and if they had bigger tanks, they would go further up and easily to the moon. The larger models of rocket-powered craft were, the first were usually about 30 to 45 feet diameter, but the larger models were all the way up to 150 feet diameter. And I think that these are the candidates for the first craft that landed on the moon, the first German craft.
So you think that the Germans went to the moon?
Absolutely. And I think that they went to the moon on a truckload or a few truckloads of kerosene and a few truckloads of liquid oxygen or hydrogen peroxide.
For those of you listening, I want you to know that this isn't as far-fetched as you may think. Somebody certainly went to the moon a long time ago, long before the Apollo space shots. I have in my library, which was printed in 1958, the minutes of a meeting which took a whole year on the colonization of the moon. And this was in 1958. And some of the photographs in that book show very clearly that before we ever left this Earth, at least publicly, somebody already had domes on the moon. And anybody who studies the NASA photographs taken of the moon by the Lunar Orbiter 4 and other of our space shots can clearly see, under great magnification, anomalous material on the moon that should not be there unless somebody is there building these things. Okay. They're actually structures, buildings, domes, tracks of vehicles, all kinds of things. So, and don't be too quick to poo-poo this. I mean, you can go down to your local library and get these books. Make sure they're printed by the U.S. Government Printing Office, published by NASA, and take you a big magnifying glass with you, and you go over those pictures. Spend a few hours and just go over those pictures, and you'll begin to see things. And you
amazing things.
You will not believe your eyes at first until you figure out that you're really seeing what you think you're seeing.
And Fred Stecken's book, We Saw Alien Bases on the Moon, is a very good introduction in that field, coming with original NASA photos with the catalog numbers under every photo.
That's correct.
And so,
I'd like to point out that it's not necessarily alien as in from some other world and some other galaxy. It could be alien as in World War II German. It could be alien as in Canadian, because we know that there are secret space programs where several of the major nations have been cooperating in secret for many years. One good book to read, if you can find it, and so far this book has not been suppressed, is called Envoys of Mankind. And I forget the authors. There's two authors. One of them is Richardson. And they're experts in space law. And in this book, Envoys of Mankind, they actually document the existence of a secret space program wherein we were cooperating with other nations to actually do things that we weren't supposed to be doing.
Beyond the wildest imagination.
That's correct.
That would dwarf the wildest fantasy.
As I've told you in previous programs, folks, science fiction is no longer fiction. Science fiction is science fact. What they're doing in secret is so incredible that it would make George Lucas and Steven Spielberg drool with envy. They are at least, and I'm being very conservative by this, they're at least 50 to 100 years ahead of what the public conceives as the state of the art of any technology.
And science fiction is used as an educational tool to bring the public, to bring the young generation of the public to a better acceptance, to an easier acceptance of these incredible devices. So, going back to the rocket-powered craft, I have absolutely no doubt that these craft were able to fly outside of the atmosphere, that they had exo-atmospheric capabilities. This can be seen in German newspaper articles. There is a very interesting crash that happened in Spitsbergen in the early 50s of a Russian-made disc. I have a Xerox copy of the original German newspaper, June of 1952, that describes in great detail that a 47-meter diameter Russian silvery disc crashed in the northern parts of Norway. It had a plexiglass cupola that broke on impact. It was probably unmanned because nobody could be found in the cabin. The dashboard was all written in Cyrillic letters. The altitude meter was graduated to 100 kilometers or 160 kilometers. We have a little problem with the quality of the Xerox copy there. But at least 100 kilometers is basically the altitude of the Vostok and the Apollo and the other, and the Gemini spaceflight.
Sure.
And
an altimeter wouldn't be able to measure much beyond that anyway.
Oh, probably they use radar or whatever other altimeters. And the distance of flight was 30,000 kilometers, which is 3/4 the circumference of the Earth. This is not no bomber at the time could do that.
Mm-hmm.
The only way that this could be achieved is through the incredible efficiency of anti-gravity propulsion, that it negates the inertia, it negates the gravitational mass. I have absolutely no doubt that the Germans were able to go in space with their rocket-powered craft. Standard V2 rocket engine, standard V2 fuel, same fuel tanks, same aluminum, for the outer and inner skull hull. The Germans also developed pressurized cabins. They had pressurized suits. There is absolutely no technological barrier to prevent them from building these stuff.
No, of course not. People seem to think there's some great mystery about going into space. Going into space is no different than going down underwater.
Exactly.
One, you have a decrease in pressure. The other, you have an increase in pressure.
Right. Yeah.
And the only thing they overcome is a breathing mixture and to be able to withstand either a negative pressure outside the hull or a positive pressure outside the hull. There is no mystery about it whatsoever. In fact, they made so much of the so-called advanced technology in the space program. It's not advanced technology at all. What it is miniaturization. The technology has been around for a long, long time, but what they've done is they've been able to miniaturize it.
And also it is a hierarchical climbing into higher classes of energies that are better and more easier able to control the lower classes of energy.
Right.
So at that time of my research, I thought that I have wrapped up and I've discovered everything there was to discover, only to find out that I have barely scratched the surface.
That's what happened to me. Every time I do that, I realize that
I haven't even begun.
Yeah, all the stuff that I know, no matter how much research I've done, no matter how many books I've read, no matter how many hours I've devoted to studying something, what I ultimately find out that I know is less than a drop in a 55-gallon drum compared to what there still is left to learn. So I quit making those kinds of judgments.
I have always believed in the maxim that the universe is not only more complex than we imagine, but it is way more complex than we can imagine.
Yes.
So, at this happy moment, I met a character that is well known in the alternative science, avant-garde science, and black project science and UFO community, an ex-scientist and engineer by the name Al Bielek, and he casually mentioned one day, but you know, the Germans landed also on the moon. I knew that he had extensive contacts in Black Project scientific, in the Black Project scientific community and in government, secret service community. But still, that was too much even for me. With my extensive library, I probably have one of the largest libraries in the country of German UFO-related material, German flying saucer-related material. I went back to my files and started thinking, and a week or two or three passed, I've discussed this brave notion with a friend of mine, and suddenly I realized that there is absolutely no technical impossibility, that it was technically and engineeringly feasible for these rocket-powered craft to go to the moon.
Sure.
And then one day I was poring and re-examining again for I don't know which time, one of the drawings of a much larger craft, I would call it a flying dreadnought, built by Schriever. It was an interesting engineering drawing published by an underground publishing house in Germany called Sanista. I'm sorry, it was published in an underground journal called Brisant, distributed by Sanista, sometimes in the 60s, but impossible to find. Even Harbinson conveniently claims that his only copy was lost by the publisher and now cannot be located anymore. His only copy of this drawing. The poor drawing that I had...
Was this drawing the same as yours?
That I don't know. But I was able to explain exactly what I needed, and he said, well, it was lost at the publishing, the printer house, printing house. Anyway, in that big drawing, the size of the craft is monstrous. The size is 60 meters diameter, which is 180 feet diameter, 30 feet tall without the legs. With the legs, it's 45 feet tall, which is about close to 150 feet diameter, 150 feet height. And I started digging into the drawing to find other supportive clues that really this was such a big height and not just a small UFO, let's say 40, 50 feet diameter. And I discovered something that on German architectural drawing, this is how you depict doors. And then suddenly a bolt of lightning struck me. I realized that what I've been looking at, these levels, were actually the floors of this craft. And I realized that I'm looking at a 10-story tall flying dreadnought. Then after this, I was able to fine read the almost impossible to read writing in German. The topmost floor was called the Kommunikationsräume, which is the communication compartment or the control room. The one deck below that was called Tagesräume, which is the daily compartment or the mess hall. Two decks below the top was called Schlafräume or sleeping compartment. And this is when I realized that the Germans probably went to the moon. The authors of the book that this drawing was initially published mentioned that it was altered on purpose by the West German government so that it cannot be duplicated by other powers. It was an interesting design of a hybrid turbine / electromagnetic propulsion that we're going to talk in a minute. We'll still have 2 minutes time. But I realized that one does not need a sleeping compartment in a craft that can circle the Earth in about an hour and a half, 2 hours.
That's correct.
I mean, even if the Germans were going to their South Polar colony, and this is something that we're going to talk later on, because it pertains to a lot of other subsequent developments of the New World Order. Even that flight from Berlin to the South Polar colony in Neuschwanland would take half an hour, maybe 1 hour. You don't need a sleeping compartment for such a short flight. This is like a tramway car.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a city transportation.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason for sleeping home would be if one takes the craft to the moon or further beyond to the planets of the solar system. And this, I think, was exactly the purpose the craft was designed for. Size-wise, the Germans were building much bigger dreadnoughts, ships and submarines, so it would have been absolutely no problem to build a hull 180 feet diameter. Technology-wise, they have already worked to quite a good mastery the art of anti-gravity through spinning hulls. The breakthrough of this design was that they were utilizing, for the first time that I know of, spinning of electromagnetic fields. Any spinning would do the job. You can either spin the brute mass, the hull of the craft,
mm-hmm.
all of the hull, or parts, the outermost parts of the hull. Or if you don't spin the hull, you can spin an electromagnetic field around the craft. Contactee accounts of UFOs claim that either the hull would be rotating, even if you examine fiction films about flying saucers, like The Day the Earth Stood Still, not a fiction film, but a clever revelatory films, educational revelatory films, let's call them a designer or engineered leak by the secret societies here, even there the flying saucers rotate when they fly. But some of the contactees would report the noise of an electric drill or an electric generator. This is simply because an electric generator is a spinning electrical machine. Maybe something spins inside a craft. If nothing spins visibly or no noise is heard of a spinning electrical machine, then a lot of contactees would report lights that spin noiselessly around the craft. Lights are high energy, fine material fields that are spun around the craft, creating the same effect, much cheaper, much easier, without any moving parts. So the road to a more efficient flying saucer, or to answer the big question, how to build a better mousetrap, a better flying saucer, is to get rid of the spinning brute mass of the hull, of the spinning material parts, towards a spinning magnetic field around the craft. And that giant Shriver design dreadnought is the first candidate that I know of. It still had gas turbines inside the hull that were producing the high-frequency electric current to drive the coils of the craft. But no part of the material hull was moving other than these gas turbines inside. It was using standard fuel, basically rocket fuel, kerosene and liquid oxidizer, probably liquid oxygen. The interesting thing is that probably in this club the Germans utilized room temperature superconductivity for the first time. I've heard stories that superconductivity is extremely easy to obtain from aluminum when aluminum is mixed with mercury and some other trace metals in the proper concentration. They would create dendritic straight linear crystals that would actually serve as the superconductivity conductors. We may safely conclude that all of the research on superconductivity is done on purpose along the wrong avenue just to keep this additional revelation from coming before the schedule of the Illuminati. If a technology is blacklisted, it is blacklisted as long as they have decided to keep it secret. So
this is the first instance that I know of superconductivity came out of a technology from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I have a memo that outlines the entire process.
I have a publication of a guy from Wright-Patterson, scientific publication. I got immediately suspicious that probably he got the idea observing some crash disk. Terrestrial or extraterrestrial, doesn't matter. I mean, physics is the same all over the universe. So I have a feeling that the Schriever electromagnetic dreadnought is probably the first big disk that landed on the moon and took the hardware and the people that started working and digging the German underground moon base there somewhere in the mid during the middle of the Second World War, 42, 43. By the time the war ended, the Germans already had a working moon base, which is not that difficult to obtain. We already know extensively from the literature that there is breathable atmosphere on the moon. They've been lied about that by NASA, and we can talk.
Well, so I showed you the colloquium on the lunar base planning, and what was one of the chapters?
Moon atmosphere.
Yes.
I have a NASA official documentary film that, funnily enough, shows the American flag fluttering and waving crazy, buffeted by the moon's winds in a supposedly vacuum environment with no atmosphere. Anyway, I think this was the first big craft that landed on the moon, and probably on some other planets later on. However, this is still the tip of the iceberg. We haven't scratched the surface. Once more, I will repeat my phone number. Anyone who's interested for additional information, I have several videos developed and an extensive pictorial information, bibliography from German books, German articles from the 40s and 50s, and photographs of these devices. My number is Los Angeles is 310-473-9717, and I think we are approaching the.
We've got about 2 minutes left. And once again, the hour is not long enough, is it?
Bill, let's hear a skeptical question.
A skeptical question.
The golden question mark award for the best skeptical question.
I know so much about this that I'm not much of a good skeptic because I understand that.
I'll tell you one then.
Most of what we've discussed is probably true. Some of it may or may not be, but it's possible. And in my own research, I've run across these same parallels that you have, and I know without any doubt whatsoever that the Germans did develop flying saucer type craft in World War II. And in my own research, I know that they successfully test flew several different types. They never perfected them to the point where they were willing or able or capable of using them as a weapons platform, or we would have lost the war, because the war was won by air power.
This is actually the best skeptical question that I'm getting invariably when I do my public speaking. Yeah. If they had all this gadgetry, how come they lost the war? And I've realized that. Well, the answer to that question is very simple. They lost the European War and they won the South Polar War.
They may have won the world.
They may have won the world because the German colony under the South Pole is still healthy, strong, and running. And we'll probably talk about this in our later session. But Renato Vesta, in his book, has about 2,000 accounts of attacks of Foo Fighters, of German flying saucers over Allied bombing formations with devastating consequences.
Yeah, we know that the Foo Fighters existed, the what they call the fireball,
yeah,
the Kugelblitz, and they worked very well at disabling the electronic circuits on their aircraft and causing them to fall out of formation and abort their bombing missions.
It's all well documented.
And one of the reasons that our pilots, at least this is what I have garnered from my research into what the pilots and the gunners said, is that they didn't know what these things were. They didn't know if they should shoot at them or not, so they never did. And since these craft never shot at them, they never perceived any harm.
And they didn't even realize what zapped them.
That's right. They had no realization of what it
was. The engines just cut out, and
their communications
went out.
Their radio quit. Nothing worked aboard the aircraft. It was electronic at all. Well, once again, I want to thank you for being on the show, Vladimir. And once again, it was a short hour. I'm going to have to ask you, will you come back and do one more with us tomorrow night?
With the greatest pleasure.
Wonderful.
With the greatest of all pleasures.
Wonderful. And for all those listening out there, I urge you to keep an open mind. I also urge you to do what I've always told you before and will continue to tell you. Don't believe anything you hear from me.
Don't believe us. Just do your homework.
That's right. Learn to do your own research and don't believe anything from anybody, not even your own mother, unless you can substantiate it through your own efforts. Good night and God bless you all.